Welcome to the New Books in Political Science podcast. My name is Heath Brown, and today I have the real pleasure to talk to the author of The Politics of Resentment, Rural Consciousness in Wisconsin and the Rise of Scott Walker. The book was published by University of Chicago Press this year, and the author is Catherine Kramer. I have the pleasure to have Catherine Kramer on the phone today to talk. Catherine, how are you doing today?
I'm great. Thank you so much for having me on your podcast.
Absolutely. A timely and interesting book. Before we get to it, why don't you tell us just a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So I'm Kathy Kramer. Pretty much everybody calls me Kathy, and I am a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and I also currently have the pleasure of serving as a faculty director of our public service center here. It's called the Morgridge Center for Public Service.
Wonderful. Yeah, you're dipping into these different areas, I think really does show up in this such an interesting book. Your book is all about Wisconsin. And so to start us, why this state? What makes it the right case to examine political resentment?
Well, I didn't set out to examine resentment. And honestly, I chose to do my study in Wisconsin because it was convenient and because I love the state. So while I was sprinting for tenure, I dreamed of doing a project on how social class identity influences the way people make sense of politics. And I wanted to design a study so that I could get out and about in Wisconsin, which I've lived in most of my life and wanted to know more about. And at the same time, I was also faculty director of a statewide public opinion poll that we used to do here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. So it served a variety of purposes. And when I applied for sabbatical time and grant money from my university to start my study, they said, great. While you're out there, please ask people what they think about the university. So the study was about Wisconsin for convenience and to help with this public opinion poll and to help my university understand how people were thinking about it and their attachment to it. And it ended up that as time went on, Wisconsin became politically extremely interesting and sort of ground zero for debates about the appropriate role of government.
Now, you also focus in the book within the state of Wisconsin on rural residents, not exclusively, but that's much of the focus of what you do. You introduce this idea of rural consciousness. Would you tell us a little bit about this idea? What does this mean exactly? And
sure.
And how is it different from the other identities that a resident of Wisconsin might have?
Sure. So I wasn't looking for, I wasn't intending to study rural folks in particular, but because I was interested in social class identity, I had sampled a wide range of communities to try to get me a wide range of people of different socioeconomic backgrounds. And what I was looking for, I'm sure you'll ask me more about this later, but I was looking for groups of people that met regularly kind of their own accord that I could invite myself into. But what happened is that I ended up spending a lot of time in smaller communities, small towns, rural communities. And what I heard was what I ended up calling this thing rural consciousness. And it's basically a resentment toward the cities, but it has several main parts. One is this identity as a rural person. A sense that, you know, I am a person from a small town in Wisconsin and that identity being very important to people, combined with a sense of injustice or distributive injustice. And that injustice had three main parts to it. One is a sense that all the power in the state belongs or is kind of in the cities. We have two main metro areas here, Madison, the state capital, and Milwaukee, which is more of the industrial center of the state. So this, you know, the sense of distributive injustice was partly about where the power is, that the decisions are made in Madison and Milwaukee and communicated out to the rest of the state, and that there isn't a lot of listening done in reverse, so that the smaller towns, rural communities in the state don't have a lot of say in the decisions that govern their lives. But then there's two other important parts to the sense of injustice too, and one is a sense that public resources are not distributed fairly and that small towns are on the short end of the stick repeatedly. They don't get their fair share of taxpayer dollars. And then the final part was a sense that smaller communities don't get their fair share of respect. So there was a sense that city folks, you city folks, that people would say to me, just don't get what rural life is like or what small town life in Wisconsin is like. And there's not a lot of respect for us or what we value or our way of life. You city folks just don't get it.
Now, let's talk, as you've alluded to so far, about how you did this research.
Sure.
What type of data did you collect, and when did you collect it?
Well, I call it political ethnography. And what I was doing was observing conversations among people who normally hang out with one another in the places that they normally hang out. So over the course of my career, I've been increasingly interested in political understanding or how people make sense of politics. And I have found over time that the best way for me to study that is to listen to people. So survey data are enormously helpful. But I find that when I want to not necessarily characterize what a broad population of people think, but instead, what are they thinking when they exhibit a certain attitude or certain point of view? What things are going through their minds as they do that? I found that listening to people talk to their own friends or own acquaintances tells me a lot about how they're viewing the world and how they're piecing together the world. So what I did was to sample a wide range of communities in the state. There were 27 municipalities in all in the end. And then I would call up a UW extension office. We have 72 counties in the state, and currently there's an extension office in each of those counties. And I would call up the extension office and I would say, where in such and such Wisconsin do people get together on a regular basis that I might be able to invite myself into? And they told me to go to gas stations and diners and McDonald's and churches. And they would say, well, you know, there's so-and-so service station, and usually most weekdays from about 6:30 to 7:30, there'll be a group of people gathered around the coffee urns. So I would, you know, drive to such-and-such Wisconsin and stay in a Super 8 nearby the night before, and then early in the morning, drive to a gas station, walk in, say, hi, I'm Kathy from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Do you mind if I join you this morning? And they would laugh and invite me in, and I would give them a business card and then a token of my appreciation, like a football schedule or pen or a post-it note from the university. And then I would say, oh, and I would also say, do you mind if I turn on my recorder? And typically people did not mind. And then I would say, I study public opinion. I'm really interested in what you think. What are the big concerns around here? And we would go from there. So I asked pointed questions, but as much as possible, I tried to let the conversation go where they wanted it to go so that I could kind of observe and discover what things they thought were related to other things, you know. So in general, my data were conversations.
Now, your book is a lot about attitudes towards government. Especially the desire to shrink the size of government. So do these rural residents that you study, and again, you don't study them exclusively, mm-hmm. but the rural residents that you interviewed simply dislike government, or is the situation a bit more complicated than that?
I think it's more complicated. I think there are many people in many areas of Wisconsin, as well as the nation, who dislike government, right? And if you look at, you know, level of trust in Congress, for example, there's quite a few of us who think that government is a little bit off the rails at the moment. But what I found is that people had a pretty complex understanding of why they didn't want to pay higher taxes, why they didn't want more government programs, and why they thought public employees were getting more than their fair share. And it, in the way I understood it, a lot of it was rooted in this perspective of rural consciousness, where people saw themselves as residents of a type of place that was in pretty significant decline, and that their economies were facing really hard times, and this is even before the Great Recession really set in, and people perceived that, you know, whatever government is doing, it's not working in our favor. And so in that respect, perhaps it was sort of a blanket disregard for government. But it was more complex in that, for example, some of the storylines that they had for themselves sounded like this, where they would say things like, it's not that we're opposed to government spending, or it's not that we're opposed to government programs in general, and that's my paraphrasing, but, you know, if we're asked to pay higher taxes and we pay in more money for education, for example, that money isn't going to come back to our community. It's not going to benefit us. So why would we ever want that? Why would we ever agree to pay higher taxes? Why would we ever want more government? So that's one way it came out.
Yeah. Now, your book is also about your governor, Scott Walker, is central to particularly the second half of the book. Tell us a little bit about Scott Walker. Did rural voters support his various elections? And what about Act 10? What has been the role of the people that you study in this controversial and pretty significant part of policymaking in the state?
Sure. So Scott Walker, when I started my study in 2007, was executive of Milwaukee County. And very few of us knew much about him. If you lived in the Milwaukee area, you did, of course. But the rest of the state, we were pretty unfamiliar with him. And then he ran for governor in 2010 and won. And so he took office in early 2011 and right away, proposed this controversial legislation, Act 10. And Act 10 is a public employee collective bargaining act. It was actually a budget sort of stopgap measure. But what it did was to basically outlaw most public unions. And it's more complicated than that, but that's the shorthand. And it also required most public employees to pay more of their paychecks into their healthcare benefits and pensions. And so it was hugely controversial and pretty quickly resulted in massive protests at our state capitol for months. And support for Scott Walker was pretty strong in what we call, many of us call, outstate Wisconsin, which is the areas beyond the Madison, Milwaukee metropolitan area. So it's the more rural part of the state. And it was strong in the gubernatorial race of 2010, even stronger in a recall election in 2012. And then in 2014, in his reelection campaign, again, those parts of the state were very strong behind Scott Walker. And one way that you can see rural consciousness working in this respect is that many people expressed to me some version of the following, and that is, you know, Kathy, I am working my rear off to make ends meet. And oftentimes this would come from people doing manual labor. You know, they felt like physically they were just exhausted from years of doing this kind of work and working multiple jobs to try to make ends meet for themselves and or their families. And we don't have health care. We can't afford health care, they would tell me. And here I am working my butt off and my taxes keep going up. And I'm supposed to work so hard to pay for health care benefits for public employees, most of whom sit behind desks all day. That doesn't make sense to me. That's extremely unfair. And so good for Scott Walker coming in and telling the public employees that they have to, you know, pay in a little bit more because I'm tired of footing the bill for people to have health care when I can't even afford it for myself.
Now, I wonder when you think about this relationship between the governor and these sentiments among some portion of the electorate in Wisconsin, how aware Scott Walker is of this resentment. I'm very interested in the sort of interplay between what voters think and how candidates and elected officials perceive those views. Yeah. Do you have any sense of how this works back and forth? Has he been instrumental in fanning the flames, or is he simply sort of reflecting what he gathers as the underlying views of those that are most likely to support him?
You know, it's hard to say. I mean, I would really love to have a conversation with him. It would be very difficult to achieve, but I really can't say whether, you know, this is someone who perceives these sentiments and is taking advantage of them, or it's someone who perceives these things and, you know, himself and feels this unfairness himself. And so, you know, who knows? But I do know he's a very savvy politician, and he has been very adept at tapping into these sentiments. And I'll give you two examples of how that worked. In the 2010 gubernatorial campaign, part of his rhetoric while running for office was that public employees are the haves and private employees are the have-nots, and that we need to bring to an end, you know, this the manner in which public employees are getting an unfair share. So that taps directly into these sentiments, right, about distributive injustice. But he also tapped into specifically this kind of mental map of who has the power and who's getting the resources, particularly around an issue involving a high-speed train line. The previous governor, or the sitting governor at the time of the 2010 election, was a Democrat by the name of Jim Doyle, and he had successfully obtained $810 million from the federal government to build a high-speed train line between the two metro areas, Madison and Milwaukee. And Scott Walker said on the campaign trail, you know, if I become governor, we are not taking that money, because that is taxpayer money. That's hard-earned taxpayer money. And that is money that is not going to fix the roads that go up to West Salem or through the cutout up to Black River Falls and named all these, you know, very or outstate small communities in the state. And he said, you know, that is money that's only going to serve those two areas, Madison and Milwaukee. So that's one example of the way you could see him tapping into that sentiment that, you know, Madison, Milwaukee get everything. And it's about time we put a stop to it and divert some of those resources elsewhere.
Now, in the conclusion to the book, you try to make some sense of the central puzzle of the book, which is in some ways why certain voters support a smaller government that might make life harder for them.
Right.
Where are you at the end of the book on figuring out this puzzle? What have you figured out that you maybe didn't understand fully at the start?
One thing is that it's really not smart to say, how can people be so stupid? Because oftentimes that puzzle gets communicated that way, right? It's, I mean, mm-hmm. in a more charitable fashion, people say, how can people vote against their interests? Well, what I heard from years and, you know, dozens, nearly 100 conversations with people was people spending a lot of energy making these pretty sophisticated interpretations of the world, and giving me all kinds of reasons for why they wouldn't want more government. And to me, that's not stupidity. It may be a very different perspective than people who are more left-leaning, but it's not stupidity. So that's one thing I learned, to try to caution, you know, myself and others from just kind of dismissing views in favor of small government as a lack of intelligence. The other thing I learned, though, is that many of these arguments about why we should want less government were rooted in resentment, and resentment towards public employees, resentment towards people in the cities, toward people of color. And I just find that to be very disturbing. And it's especially disturbing given where I started with this project, which is I wanted to study public opinion in Wisconsin because I find the people of the state to be delightful. And you know, I grew up here. I'm biased in that respect, but it's been very sobering to me to see how widespread resentment is in this state and the manner in which our politicians are making arguments to us kind of on the backs of our fellow citizens as opposed to on the merits of policy. And much to my surprise, I would like to say I was, you know, so smart that I saw this coming, but this that manner of resentment is all over this presidential campaign. And, you know, Donald Trump is probably the most blatant example, but, you know, this making arguments about you're right, you're not getting your fair share, and it's all their fault, whether it's immigrants or Muslims or women or what have you. I just don't see how we actually have democracy if that's the nature of our political rhetoric. Because in my mind, yes, I know we have a representative democracy, but at some level, democracy is about us governing each other. And unless we are making our choices on the basis of what's going to lift us all up, it's not a great future ahead of us.
Yeah, the book, again, is The Politics of Resentment, Rural Consciousness in Wisconsin and the Rise of Scott Walker, published by the University of Chicago Press this year and available, I'm sure, at their website. Kathy Kramer, thank you so much for your book and your interesting talk today.
Thank you so much, Heath. It's really a pleasure to be on your show.